hours, maybe. I'm sure it would be a blessing if we could herd a few up that way. I don't suppose there's a decent woman in the whole territory yet. The thought struck him that there could be no getting to Montana without crossing the Platte, and Clara lived on the Platte. Bob Allen or no, she would ask him to supper, if only to show off her girls. Jake's news might be out of date. Maybe she had even run her husband off since Jake had passed through. Anyway, husbands had been got around a few times in the history of the world, if only to the extent of having to set a place for an old rival at the supper table. Such thoughts put the whole prospect in a more attractive light. "How far do you reckon it is to Montana, Carl?" he asked. Carl looked north across the dusty flats, as if estimating in his mind's eye the great rise of the plain stretching even farther than hearsay, away and beyond the talk of men. Jake that morning had mentioned the Milk River, a stream he had never heard of. He knew the country he knew, and had never been lost in it. But the country he knew stopped at the Arkansas River. He had known men to speak of the Yellowstone as if it were the boundary of the world. Even Kit Carson, whom he had met twice, had not talked of what lay north of it. But then his memory went back to a camp they had made on the Brazos many years before with an army captain. There was a Delaware scout with him who had been farther than any man they knew, all the way to the headwaters of the Missouri. "Remember Black Beaver Gus?" he said. "He'd know how far it was." "Yeah, I remember him. It was always a puzzle to me how such a short-legged Indian could cover so much ground." "He claimed to have been all the way from the Columbia to the Rio Grande," Carl said. "That's knowing the country, I'd say." "Well, he was an Indian. He didn't have to go along establishing law and order and making it safe for bankers and Sunday school teachers like we done. I guess that's why you're ready to head off to Montana. You want to help establish a few more banks."
"That's aggravating," Carl said. "I ain't a banker."
"No, but you done many a banker a good turn," Augustus said. "That's what we done, you know. Killed the darn Indians so they wouldn't bother the bankers."
"Well, they bothered more than bankers," Carl said.
"Yes, lawyers and doctors and newspaper men and drummers of every description," Augustus said.
"Not to mention women and children," Carl said. "Not to mention plain settlers."
"Why, women and children and settlers are just cannon fodder for lawyers and bankers," Augustus said. "They're all part of the schemes. After the Indians wipe out enough of them to get your public outcry, and we go chouse the Indians out of the way, and if they keep coming back, then the army takes over and chouses them worse. Finally, the army will manage to whip them down to where they can be squeezed onto some reservation, so the lawyers and the bankers can come in and get civilization started. Every bank in Texas ought to pay us a commission for the work that we done. If we hadn't done it, all the bankers would still be back in Georgia, living on poke salad and turnip greens."
"I don't know why you stuck with it. That's the way you think," Carl said. "You should have gone home and taught school."
"Hell no. I wanted to look at it before the bankers and lawyers get it."
"Well, they ain't got to Montana," Carl said.
"If we go, they won't be far behind," Augustus said. "First ones that get there will hire you to go out and hang all the horse thieves and bring in whichever Indians have got the most fight left, and you'll do it, and the place will be civilized. And then you won't know what to do with yourself, no more than you have the last 10 years.
"I ain't a boy," Carl said. "I'll be dead before all that happens. Anyhow, I ain't going there to law. I'm going there to run cattle. Jake said it was a cattleman's paradise."
"You ain't a cattleman, Carl. No more than I am. If we was to get a ranch, I don't know who would run it."
It seemed to Carl a mare had probably stood on 3 legs long enough, and he had surely jawed with Gus long enough. Sometimes Gus sang a strange tune. He had killed as many Indians as any ranger. He had seen enough of their butchery that you'd think that he knew why he was doing it. And yet when he talked, he seemed to be on their side. "As to the ranch," he said, "the boy could run it. He's nearly grown." Augustus puzzled over that for a moment, as if it had never occurred to him.
Well, maybe so, Carl, he said. I guess he could run it if he was a mind to, and if you would let him.
I don't know why he wouldn't be a mind to, Carl said, and walked over to the mare.
Chapter 8.
By the middle of the afternoon, it was so hot nobody could think. At least Newt couldn't, and the other hands didn't seem to be thinking very fast either. All they could find to argue about was whether it was hotter down in the well digging or up in the sun working the windlass. Down in the well, they all worked so close together and sweated so much it practically made a fog, while up in the sun, fog was no problem. Being down in the well made Newt nervous, particularly if Pea was with him, because when Pea got to work in the crowbar, he didn't always look where he was jabbing, and once he had almost jabbed it through Newt's foot. From then on, Newt works frattle legs so as to keep his feet out of the way. They were going at it hard when the captain came riding back, having lathered the mare good by loping her along the river for about 20 miles. He rode her right up to the well. "Hello, boys," he said. "Ain't the water flowing yet?" "It's flowing," Dish said. "A gallon or two of it flowed out of me." "Be thankful you're healthy," Carl said. "A man that couldn't sweat would die in this heat." "I don't suppose you'd trade for that mare," Dish asked. "I like the looks of her." "You ain't the first that's liked them," Carl said. "I'll keep her, I believe. But you boys can stop work now and catch a little rest. We have to go to Mexico tonight." They all went over and sat in the alleyway of a barn. It had a little shade in it. The minute they sat down, Dietz began to patch his pants. He kept a big needle and some heavy thread in a cigar box in the saddle shed. Given any chance, he would get out his needle and start patching. He was woolly-headed, and his wool was just getting gray. "If I was you, I'd give up on them pants," Dish said. "If you got to wear quilts, you best find a new one. Start over." "No, sir," Dietz said genially. "These pants got to last." Newt was a little excited. The captain hadn't separated him from the rest of the men when he told them to rest. It might mean that he was going to get to go to Mexico at last. On the other hand, he had been down in the well, so the captain might have just forgotten him. "I do fancy that mare," Dish said. The captain was unsaddling her. "I don't see why," P said. "She near killed the captain just yesterday. Bit a hunk out of him the size of my foot." They all looked at P's foot, which was about the size and the shape of a scoop shovel. "I'd say that passes belief," Dish said. "Her whole head ain't the size of your foot. If that chunk had come out of you, you'd have thought it was big enough, I guess," P said mildly. After Dish had caught his breath, he pulled his case knife out of his pocket and asked if anyone wanted a game of root to peg. Newt had a pocket knife, too, and was quick to take him up. The game involved flipping the knives in various ways and making them stick in the dirt. Dish won, and Newt had to dig a peg out of the ground with his teeth. Dish drove the peg in so far that Newt had dirt up his nose before he finally got it out. The sight amused P no end. "By gosh, Newt, if we break a crowbar, you can finish digging the well with your nose," he said. While they were sitting around, idly experimenting with a few new knife throws, they heard the clop of horses and looked up to see two riders approaching from the east in an easy trot. "Now, who would that be?" P asked. "It's an odd time of day to visit." "Well, if it ain't old Juan Cortinas, it's probably a couple of bank robbers," Dish said, referring to a Mexican cattle thief who was hailed south of the river as a great hero due to the success of his raids against the Texans. "No, it ain't Cortinas," P.I. said, squinting at the riders. "He always rides a gray." Dish could hardly believe anyone could be so dumb as to believe that Juan Cortinas would just ride into Lonesome Dove with only one man. The men stopped on the far side of the lots to read the sign Augustus had put up when the Hat Creek outfit had gone in business. All Carl wanted on the sign was the simple words, "Hat Creek Livery Stable," but Augustus could not be persuaded to stop at a simple statement like that. It struck him that it would be best to put their rates on the sign. Carl had been for tacking up one board with the name on it to let people know the livery stable was available, but Augustus thought that hopelessly unsophisticated. He bestirred himself and found an old plank door that had blown off somebody's root cellar, perhaps by the same wind that had taken their roof. He nailed the door onto one corner of the corrals, facing the road, so that the first thing most travelers saw when entering town was the sign. In the end, he and Call argued so much about what was going on the sign that Call got disgusted and washed his hands of the whole project. That suited Augustus fine, since he considered that he was the only person in Lonesome Dove with enough literary talent to write a sign. When the weather was fair, he would go sit in the shade the sign cast and think of ways to improve it. In the 2 or 3 years since they had put it up, he had thought of so many additions to the original simple declaration that practically the whole door was covered. At first he started out spare and just put the name of the firm, Hat Creek Cattle Company and Livery Emporium. But that caused controversy in itself. Call claimed that nobody knew what an emporium was, including himself, and he still didn't, despite Augustus's many long-winded attempts to explain it to him. All Call knew was that they didn't run one, and he didn't want one, whatever it was, and there was no way something like that could fit with a cattle company. However, Augustus had his way, and Emporium went on the sign. He mainly put it in because he wanted visitors to know that there was at least one person in Lonesome Dove who knew how to spell important words. Next, he had put his name and Call's, his first, because he was 2 years older and felt seniority should be honored. Call didn't care. His pride ran in other directions. Anyway, he soon came to dislike the sign so much that he would just as soon have not had his name on it at all. P.I. badly wanted his name on the sign, so 1 year Augustus lettered it in for him as a Christmas present. P., of course, couldn't read, but he could look, and once he got his name located on the sign, he was quick to point it out to anyone who happened to be interested. He had already pointed it out to Dish, who wasn't interested particularly. Unfortunately, it had been 3 decades since anyone had called P. anything but P., and even Call, who had been the man to accept him into the Rangers, couldn't remember his real first name, though he knew his last name was Parker. Having no wish to embarrass the man, Augustus had written him in as P. E. Parker, Wrangler. He had wanted to list him as a blacksmith, since in truth P. was a superior blacksmith and only an average wrangler, but P.I. thought that he could sit a horse as well as anyone and didn't wish to be associated publicly with a lower trade. Newt recognized that he was rightly too young to have his name on the sign and never suggested the possibility to anyone, though it would have pleased him mightily if someone had suggested it for him. No one did. But then Dietz had to wait nearly 2 years before his name appeared on the sign, and Newt resigned himself to waiting too. Of course, it had not occurred to Augustus to put Dietz's name on, Dietz being a black man, but when P's name was added, there was a lot of discussion about it, and around that time, Dietz developed a tremendous case of the sulks, unlike him and perplexing to Call. Dietz had ridden with him for years, through all weathers and all dangers, over country so barren that they had more than once had to kill a horse to have meat, and in all those years, Dietz had given cheerful service. Then, all because of the sign, he went into a sulk and stayed in it until Augustus finally spotted him looking wistfully at it one day and figured it out. When Augustus told Call about his conclusion, Call was further outraged. "That damn sign's ruined this outfit," he said, and went into a sulk himself. He had known Augustus was vain, but would have never suspected Dietz or P. of such a failing. Of course, Augustus was happy to add Dietz's name to the sign, although, as in the case of P., there was some trouble with the particulars. Simply writing Dietz on the sign didn't work. Dietz couldn't read either, but he could see that his name was far too short in comparison with the others. At least it was short in comparison with the other names on the sign, and Dietz wanted to know why. "Well, Dietz, you just got one name," Augustus said. "Most people got two. Maybe you got two and just forgot one of them." Dietz sat around thinking for a day or two, but he could not remember ever having another name, and Call's recollection bore him out. At that point, even Augustus began to think that the sign was more trouble than it was worth, since it was turning out to be so hard to please everyone. The only solution was to think up another name to go with Dietz. But while they were debating various possibilities, Dietz's memory suddenly cleared. "Josh," he said one night after supper, to the surprise of everyone. "Why, I'm Josh. Can you write that, Mr. Gus?" "Josh is short for Joshua," Augustus said. "I can write either of them. Joshua's the longest."
"Write the longest," Dietz said. "I'm too busy for a short name."
That made no particular sense, nor were they ever able to get Dietz to specify how he happened to remember that Josh was his other name. Augustus wrote him on the sign as Dietz Joshua, since he had already written the Dietz. Fortunately, Dietz's vanity did not extend to needing a title, although Augustus was tempted to write him in as a prophet. It would have gone with the Joshua, but Carl had a fit when he mentioned it.
"You'll have us the laughing stock of this whole country," Carl said. "Suppose somebody come up to Dietz and ask him to prophesy."
Dietz himself thought that was an amusing prospect.
"Why, I could do it, Captain," he said. "I'd prophesy hot, and I'd prophesy dry, and I'd charge him a dime."
Once the names were settled, the rest of the sign was a simple matter. There were two categories, things for rent and things for sale. Horses and rigs were available for rental, or at least horses and one rig, a spring buggy with no springs that they had bought for once after his wife, Teresa, had gotten smashed by it. For sale, Augustus listed cattle and horses. As an afterthought, he added goats and donkeys, neither bought nor sold, since he had no patience with goats and call even less with donkeys. Then, as another afterthought, he added, "We don't rent pigs," which occasioned yet another argument with Carl.
"Why, they'll think we're crazy here when they see that," he said. "Nobody in their right mind would want to rent a pig. What would you do with a pig once you rented it?"
"Why, there's plenty of useful tasks pigs can do," Augustus said. "They can clean out the snakes out of a cellar, if a man had a cellar, or they can soak up the mud puddles. Stick a few pigs in a mud puddle, and pretty soon the puddle's gone."
It was a burning day, and Carl was sweated down. "If I could find anything as cool as a mud puddle, I'd soak it up myself," he said.
"Anyhow, Carl, a sign's a kind of a tease," Augustus said. "It ought to make a man stop and consider just what it is he wants out of life in the next few days."
"If he thinks he wants to rent a pig, he's not a man I'd want for a customer," Carl said.
The caution about pigs ended the sign to Augustus's satisfaction, at least for a while. But after a year or two had passed, he decided it would add dignity to it all if the sign ended in a Latin motto. He had an old Latin school book that had belonged to his father. It was thoroughly battered from having been in the saddlebags for years. It had a few pages of mottos in the back, and Augustus spent many happy hours poring over them, trying to decide which might look best at the bottom of the sign. Unfortunately, the mottos had not been translated, perhaps because by the time the students got to the back of the book, they were supposed to be able to read Latin. Augustus had had only a fleeting contact with the language and had no real opportunity to improve his knowledge. Once he had been caught in an ice storm on the plains and had torn out a number of pages of the grammar in order to get a fire started. He had kept himself from freezing, but at the cost of most of the grammar and vocabulary. What was left didn't help him much with the mottos at the end of the book. However, it was his view that Latin was mostly for looks anyway, and he devoted himself to the mottos in order to find one with the best look. The one he settled on was Uva Uvum Vivendo Varia Fit, which seemed to him a beautiful motto, whatever it meant. One day, when nobody was around, he went out and lettered it onto the bottom of the sign, just below "We Don't Rent Pigs." Then he felt that his handiwork was complete. The whole sign read, "Hat Creek Cattle Company and Livery Emporium, Captain Augustus McCrae, Captain W. F. Call. Props, P. E. Parker, Wrangler, Dietz, Joshua, for rent, horses and rigs, for sale, cattle and horses, goats and donkeys, neither bought nor sold, we don't rent pigs, Uva Uvum, Vivendo Varia Fit." Augustus didn't say a word about the motto, and it was a good 2 months before anybody even noticed it, which showed how unobservant the citizens of Lonesome Dove really were. It galled Augustus severely that no one appreciated the fact that he had thought to write a Latin motto on a sign that all visitors could see as they rode in, though in fact those riding in took as little note of it as those already in, perhaps because getting to Lonesome Dove was such a hot, exhausting business. The few people who accomplished it were in no mood to stop and study erudite signs. More galling still was the fact that no member of his own firm had noticed the motto. Not even Newt, from whom Augustus expected a certain alertness. Of course, 2 members of the firm were totally illiterate. 3, if you chose to count Bolivar, and he wouldn't have known Latin from Chinese. Still, the way they casually treated the sign as just a part of the landscape caused Augustus to brood a good deal about the contempt that familiarity breeds. Call did finally notice the motto one day, but only because his horse happened to throw a shoe across the road from the sign. When he got down to pick up the shoe, he glanced over and noticed some curious writing below the part about pigs. He had a notion that the words were Latin, but that didn't explain what they were doing on the sign. Augustus was on the porch at the time, consulting his jug and keeping out of the way. "What the hell did you do now?" Call asked. "Wasn't the part about the pigs bad enough for you?" "What's the last part say?" "It says a little Latin," Augustus said, undisturbed by his partner's surly tone. "Why Latin?" Call asked. "I thought it was Greek you knew." "I did know my letters once," he said. He was fairly drunk and feeling melancholy about all the sinking he had done in the world. Throughout the rough years, the Greek alphabet had leaked out of his mind a letter at a time. In fact, the candle of knowledge he had set out with had burned down to a sorry stub. "So what's it say, that Latin?" Call asked. "It's a motto," Augustus said. "It just says itself." He was determined to conceal for as long as possible the fact that he didn't know what the motto meant, which anyway was nobody's business. He had written it on the sign. Let others read it. Call was quick to see the point. "You don't know yourself," he said. "It could say anything. For all you know, it invites people to rob us." Augustus got a laugh out of that. "The first bandit that comes along can read Latin is welcome to rob us, as far as I'm concerned," he said. "I'd risk a few nags for the opportunity of shooting at an educated man for a change." After that, the argument about the motto or the appropriateness of the sign as a whole surfaced intermittently when there was nothing else to argue about around the place. Of the people who actually had to live closest to the sign, Dietz liked it best, since in the afternoon the door it was written on afforded a modest spot of shade in which he could sit and let his sweat dry. No one else got much use out of it, and it was unusual to see 2 horsemen on a hot afternoon stop and read the sign instead of loping on into Lonesome Dove to wet their dusty gullets. "I guess they're professors," Dish said. "They sure like to read." Finally, the men trotted on around the barn. One was a stocky red-faced man about the age of the captain. The other was a tiny feist of a fellow with a pocked face and a big pistol strapped to his leg. The red-faced man was obviously the boss. His black horse was no doubt the envy of many a man. The little man rode a Gruula that was practically sway-backed. "Ben, I'm Wilberger," the older man said. "That's a damned amusing sign." "Well, Mr. Gus wrote it," Newt said, trying to be friendly. It would certainly please Mr. Gus that somebody with a liking for signs had finally come along. "However, if I had a mind to rent pigs, I'd be mighty upset," Wilberger said. "Man that likes to rent pigs won't be stopped." "He'd be stopped if he was to show up here," Newt said after a bit. Nobody else spoke up, and he felt that Will Barger's remark demanded an answer. "Well, is this a cow outfit, or have you boys run off from a circus?" Will Barger asked. "Oh, we cow a little," P said. "How much cowing are you likely to need?" "I need 40 horses, which it says on that sign you sell," Will Barger said. "A darn bunch of Mexicans run off darn near all of our remuda 2 nights back. I got a herd of cattle gathered up on the other side of the New Aces.
and I don't plan to walk 'em to Kansas on foot. The feller told me you men could supply horses. Is that true?
Yep, P.I. said. What's more, we can even chase the Mexicans.
I've got no time to discuss Mexicans. You gentlemen could just trot out about 40 well-broke horses. We'll pay you and be on our way.
Newt felt a little embarrassed. He was well aware that 40 horses was out of the question, but he had hated to come right out and say so. Also, as the youngest member of the outfit, it was not his responsibility to be the spokesman.
You best talk to the captain about it, he suggested. Captain handles all the deals.
Oh, Will Barger said, wiping the sweat off his brow with his forearm.
If I'd noticed the captain, I'd have picked him to talk to in the first place, instead of you circus hands. Does he happen to live around here?
He pointed at the house 50 yards away in the chaparral.
I expect he's home, he said. You men ought to publish a newspaper. You're plumb full of information.
His pockmarked companion found the remark wonderfully funny. To everyone's surprise, he let out a cackle of a laugh, like the sound a hen might make if a hen were mad about something.
Which way's the whorehouse? He asked when he finished his cackle.
Chick, you're a sight, Will Barger said, turned his horse, and trotted off toward the house.
Which way's the whorehouse? Chick asked again.
He was looking at Dish, but Dish had no intention of revealing Lorena's whereabouts to an ugly little cowboy on a sway-backed horse.
It's over in Sabina's, Dish said matter-of-factly.
Which?
Chick asked, caught a little off guard.
Sabina's, Dish repeated. Just wade the river and ride southeast for about a day. You'll likely strike it.
Newt thought it extremely clever of Dish to come out with such a remark, but Chick clearly didn't appreciate the cleverness. He was frowning, which tensed his small face up and made his deep pockmarks look like holes that went clear through his cheeks.
I didn't ask for no map of Mexico, he said. I've been told there's a yellow-haired girl right in this town.
Dish slowly got to his feet. Well, just my sister, he said. Of course, it was a rank lie, but it got the job done. Chick was not convinced by the information, but Will Barger had ridden off and left him, and he was conscious of being outnumbered and disliked. To imply that a cowboy's sister was a sporting woman might lead to prolonged fisticuffs, if not worse, and Dish Boguette looked to be a healthy specimen.
In that case, some fool has told me wrong, Chick said, turning his horse toward the house.
P.I., who liked to take life one simple step at a time, had not appreciated the subtleties of the situation.
Where'd you get a sister, Dish? He asked.
P.'s mode of living was modeled on the captain's. He barely went in the dry bean twice a year, preferring to wet his whistle on the front porch where he would be assured of a short walk to bed if it got too wet. When he saw a woman and made him uncomfortable, the danger of deviating from proper behavior was too great. Generally, when he spotted a female in his vicinity, he took the modest way and kept his eyes on the ground. Nonetheless, he had chanced to look up one morning as they were trailing a herd of Mexican cattle through Lonesome Dove. He had seen a yellow-haired girl looking out an open window at him. Her shoulders were bare, which startled him so that he dropped a rein. He had not forgotten the girl, and he occasionally stole a glance at the window if he happened to be riding by. It was a surprise to think that she might have been Dish's sister.
P., when was you born? Dish asked, grinning at Newt.
The question threw P. into confusion. He had been thinking about the girl he had seen in the window. To be asked when he was born meant stopping one line of thought and trying to shift to another, more difficult line.
Why, you best ask the captain that, Dish, he said mildly.
I can't even remember.
Well, since we got the afternoon off, I believe I'll take a stroll, Dish said. He ambled off toward town.
The prospect of getting to go with the men that night kept crowding into Newt's mind. Where do you go when you go down south? He asked P., who was still ruminating on the subject of his own birth.
Oh, we just lope around until we strike some stock, P. said.
Captain knows where to look.
I hope I get to go, Newt said.
Dietz clapped him on the shoulder with a big black hand.
You in a hurry to get shot at? My lord, he said.
Then he walked over and stood looking down into the unfinished well. Dietz was a man of few words, but many looks. Newt had often had the feeling that Dietz was the only one in the outfit who really understood his wishes and needs. Bolivar was kind from time to time, and Mr. Gus was usually kind, though his kindness was of a rather absent-minded nature. He had many concerns to talk and argue about, and it was mostly when he got tired of thinking about everything else that he had time to think about Newt. The captain was seldom really harsh with him unless he made a pure mess of some job, but the captain never passed him a kind word either. A captain did not go around handing out kind words. But if he was in the mood to do so, Newt knew that he would be the last to get one. No compliment ever came to him from the captain, no matter how well he worked. It was a little discouraging. The harder he tried to please the captain, the less the captain seemed to be pleased. When Newt managed to do some job right, the captain seemed to feel that he had been put under an obligation, which puzzled Newt and made him wonder what was the point of working well if it was only going to aggravate the captain. And yet all the captain seemed to care about was working well. Dietz noticed his discouragement and did what he could to help pick his spirits up. Sometimes he helped out with jobs that were too much for Newt, and whenever a chance for complimenting a piece of work came, Dietz paid the compliment himself. It was a help, though it couldn't always make up for the feeling Newt had that the captain held something against him. Newt had no idea what it could be, but it seemed there was something. Dietz was the only one beside himself who seemed to be aware of it. But Newt never could work up the nerve to question Dietz about it directly. He knew Dietz wouldn't want to talk about such things. Dietz didn't talk much anyway. He tended to express himself more with his eyes and his hands. While Newt was thinking of the night in Mexico, Dish Bogart strolled happily toward the Dry Bean Saloon, thinking of Lorena. All day, laboring at the windlass or in the well, he had thought of her. The night had not gone as well as he had hoped it would. Lorena had not given him anything that could be construed as encouragement. But it occurred to Dish that maybe she just needed more time to get used to the notion that he loved her. If he could stay around a week or two, she might get used to it, even come to like it. Behind the general store, an old Mexican saddle maker was cutting a steer hide into strips from which to make a rope. It occurred to Dish that he might be more presentable if he walked down to the river and washed off some of the sweat that had dried on him during the day. But walking to the river meant losing time, and he decided to let that notion slide. What he did do was stop just back of the dry bean to tuck his shirt tail in more neatly and dust off his pants. It was while he was attending to his shirt tail that he suddenly got a shock. He had stopped about 20 feet behind the building, which was just two stories of frame lumber. It was a still, hot afternoon, no breeze blowing. A strong fart could have been heard far up the street, but it was no fart that caught Dish's ear. When he first heard the steady crackling, creaking sound, he thought nothing of it. But a second or two later, something dawned on him that almost made him feel sick. In spite of himself, he stepped closer to the building to confirm his fear. From the corner just over his head, where Lorena had her room, came a crackling and a creaking sound, such as two people can make in a bad bed with a corn-shuck mattress over a weak spring. Lorena had such a bed. Only last night it had made the same noise beneath them, loud enough that Dish wondered briefly, before pleasure overtook him, if anybody besides themselves was hearing it. Now he was hearing it, standing with his shirt tail half tucked in, while someone else was making it with Lorena. Memories of her body mingled with the sound, causing such a painful feeling in Dish's breast that for a second he couldn't move. He felt almost paralyzed, doomed to stand in the heat beneath the very room that he had been hoping to enter himself. She was part of the sound. He knew just what chord she contributed to the awful music. Anger began to fill him, and for a moment its object was Xavier Wands, who could at least have seen that Lorena had a cotton tick mattress instead of those scratchy corn shucks, which weren't even comfortable to sleep on. In a second, though, Dish's anger passed Xavier by and surged in the direction of the man in the room above him, who was also above Lorena, using her body to produce the crackling and the creaking. He had no doubt it was the pockmarked weasel on the swayback gray, who had probably pretended to ride up to the house and then cut back down the dry bed of the creek straight to the saloon. It would be a move he would soon regret. Dish belted his pants and strode grimly around the saloon to the north side. It was necessary to go all the way around the building to get out of hearing of the bed sounds. He fully meant to kill the little weasel when he came out of the saloon. Dish was no gunfighter, but some things could not be borne. He took out his pistol and checked his loads, surprised at how fast life could suck you along. That morning he had awoke with no plans except to be a cowboy, and now he was about to become a man-killer, which would put his whole future in doubt. The man might have powerful friends who would hunt him down. Still, feeling what he felt, he could see no other course to follow. He holstered his pistol and stepped around the corner, expecting to stand by the swayback gray until the cowboy came out, so the challenge could be given. But stepping around the corner brought another shock. There was no swayback gray tied to the hitch rail in front of the saloon. In fact, there were no horses at all in front of the saloon. Over at Pumphrey's store, a couple of big strapping boys were loading rolls of bob wire into a wagon. Otherwise, the street was empty. It put Dish in a deep quandary. He had been more than ready to commit murder, but now he had no victim to commit it on. For a moment he tried to convince himself he hadn't heard what he had heard. Perhaps Lorena was just bouncing on the corn shucks for the sake of bouncing. But that theory wouldn't hold. Even a light-hearted girl wouldn't want to bounce on a corn shuck mattress on a hot afternoon. And anyway, Lorena wasn't a light-hearted girl. Some man had prompted the bouncing. The question was who? Dish looked inside, only to discover that the dry bean was as empty as a church house on Saturday night. There was no sign of Xavier or Lippy. And worse, the creaking hadn't stopped. He could still hear it from the front door. It was too much for Dish. He hurried off the porch and up the street, but it soon hit him that he had no place to go, not unless he wanted to collect his horse and strike out for Matagorda, leaving Captain Call to think what he would. Dish wasn't quite ready to do that, at least not until he found out who his rival was. Instead, he walked up one side of the street and down the other, feeling silly for doing it. He went all the way to the river, but there was nothing to see there except a strip of brown water and a big coyote. A coyote stood in the shallow, eating a frog. Dish sat by the river an hour. When he got back to the dry bean, everything was back to normal. Xavier Wands was standing at the door with a wet rag in his hand, and Lippy was sitting on the bar, shaving a big corn off his thumb with a straight razor. They didn't count for much in Dish's view. What counted was that Lorena, looking prettily flushed, was sitting at a table with Jake Spoon, a coffee-eyed stranger with a pearl-handled pistol. Jake had his hat pushed back on his head and was addressing her, with his eyes at least, as if he had known her for years. There was a single glass of whiskey sitting on the table. From the doorway, Dish saw Lorena take a sip out of the glass and then casually hand it to Jake, who took more than a sip. The sight embarrassed Dish profoundly. It went to the pit of his stomach, like the sound of the creaking bed when he first heard it. He had never seen his ma and pa drink from the same glass, and they had been married people. And yet the day before, he had been practically unable to get Lori to look at him at all, and him a top hand, not just some drifter. In a flash, as he stood half through the swinging doors, Dish's whole conception of women changed. It was as if lightning had struck, burning his old notions to a crisp in one instant. Nothing was going to be as he had imagined it. Maybe nothing ever would again. He started to go back out the door so he could at least go off and adjust to his new life alone, but he had lingered a moment too long. Both Jake and Lorena looked up from one another and saw him at the door. Lorena didn't change expression, but Jake at once gave him a friendly look and lifted his hand. "Hooray! Come on in, son. I hope you've the start of a crowd. If there's anything I can't stand, it's a darn gloomy saloon." Lippy, content beneath his bowler, turned and shook his lip in Dish's direction for a moment. Then he blew the shavings of his corn off the bar. "Dish ain't much of a crowd," he said. Dish stepped in, wishing once again that he had never heard of the town of Lonesome Dove. Jake Spoon waved at Xavier.
"Davy, bring your poison," he said. "Anybody that's had to dig a darn well in this heat deserves a free drink, and I'm buying it," Jake added.
He motioned at a chair, and Dish took it, feeling red in the face one second and pale the next. He longed to know what Lorena was feeling about it all, and when Jake turned his head a minute, he cast her a glance. Her eyes were unusually bright, but they didn't see him. They returned continually to Jake, who was paying her no particular mind. She tapped her fingers on the table three or four times, a little absently, as if keeping time with her own thoughts, and she drank two more sips from Jake's glass. There were tiny beads of sweat above her upper lip, one right at the edge of the faint scar, but she didn't look bothered by the heat or anything else. Dish could hardly pull his eyes away. She was so pretty. And when he did, he caught Jake Spoon looking at him. But Jake's look was entirely friendly. He seemed plain glad for company.
"If I was to try well digging, I doubt I'd survive an hour," he said. "You boys ought to stand up to Call and make him dig his own well."
At that point, Xavier brought out a bottle and a glass.
Jake took the bottle himself and poured liberally.
"This is better liquor than they got in Arkansas," he said.
At that point, Dish felt himself lose belief in what was happening. There was no place he would rather not be than at a table with Laurie and another man. Yet that appeared to be where he was. Laurie didn't seem to mind him being there, but on the other hand, it was clear she would not have minded if he were 1,000 miles away. With Jake's hat pushed back, Dish could see a little strip of white skin right at his forehead, skin the sun never struck. For a time, Dish lost all sense of what life was about. He even lost the sense that he was a cowboy, the strongest sense he had to work with. He was just a fellow with a glass in his hand whose life had suddenly turned to mud. The day before, he had been a top hand, but what did it mean anymore? Though the day was hot and bright, Dish felt cold and cloudy, so puzzled by the strange business called life that he couldn't think where to look, much less what to say. He took a drink, and then another, and then several. And though life remained cloudy, the inside of the cloud began to warm. By the middle of the second bottle, he had stopped worrying about Laurie, and Jake Spoon was sitting by the piano, singing "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean" while Lippy played.
Chapter 9.
Augustus was on the front porch biding his time when Wilberger rode up. Biding his time seemed to him the friendly thing to do, insomuch as Jake Spoon had ridden a long way and had likely been scared to seek out womankind during his trip. Jake was one of those men who seemed to stay in rut a year round, a great source of annoyance to Call, who was never visibly in rut. Augustus was subject to it, but, as he often said, he wasn't going to let it drive him like a mule, a low joke that still went over the heads of most of the people who heard it. He enjoyed a root, as he called it, but if conditions weren't favorable, could make do with whiskey for lengthy spells. It was clear that with Jake just back, conditions weren't too favorable that afternoon, so he repaired to his jug with the neighborly intention of giving Jake an hour or two to whittle down his need before he followed along and tried to interest him in a card game. Wilberger, of course, was a surprise. He trotted his big black horse right up to the porch, which surprised the blue pigs as much as it did Augustus. They woke up and grunted at the horse. Wilberger looked enviously at Augustus's jug. "By God, I bet that ain't persimmon juice you're drinking. I wish I could afford an easy life. If you was to dismount and stop scaring my pigs, you'd be welcome to a drink," Augustus said. "We can introduce ourselves later." Ashote got up and walked right underneath the black horse, which was well broke enough that it didn't move. Wilberger was more shocked than the horse. In fact, Augustus was shocked himself. Ashote had never done such a thing before, though he had always been an unpredictable shote. "I guess that's one of the pigs you don't rent," Wilberger said. "If I'd have been riding my mare, she'd have kicked it so far you'd have had to hunt to find your bacon." "Well, that pig had been asleep," Augustus said. "I guess it didn't expect a horse to be standing there when it woke up." "Which are you, Call or McCrae?" Wilberger asked, tired of discussing the pigs.
I'm McCrae, Augusta said. Call wouldn't put up with this much jabbering.
Can't blame him. I'm Wilberger.
At that moment, Call stepped out of the house. In fact, his bite had pained him all day, and he had been in the process of making himself a poultice of cactus pulp. It took a while to make, which is why he had come in early. As he came out on the porch, a small man on a gray came riding around the house.
Why, hell, you had us surrounded and we didn't even know it, Augusta said. This is Captain Call, standing here with his shirt tail out.
I'm Wilberger.
This is my man, Chick.
You're free to get down, Call said.
Oh, well, Wilberger said. Why get down when I would soon just have to climb back up? It's unnecessary labor. I hear you men trade horses.
We do, Call said. Cattle, too.
Don't bother me about cattle, Wilberger said. I got 3,000 head ready to start up the trail. What I need is a remuda.
And it's a pity that cattle can't be trained to carry riders, Augusta said.
The thought had just occurred to him, so following his habit, he put it at once into speech. Both Call and Wilberger looked at him as if he were daft.
You may think it a pity, Wilberger said. I can call it a blessing. I suppose you wrote that sign.
That's right, Augusta said. Want me to write you one?
No, I ain't ready for a sanatorium yet, Wilberger said. Never expected to meet Latin in this part of Texas, but I guess education has spread.
How'd you round up that much stock without horses, Call asked, hoping to get the conversation back around to business.
Oh, well, I just trained a bunch of jackrabbits to chase them out of the brush, Wilberger said, a bit testy. In fact, some darn Mexicans stole our horses, he added. I had heard you men hung all the Mexican horse thieves when you were rangers, but I guess you missed a few.
By hell, we hung every one of them, Augusta said,
glad to see that their visitor was of an argumentative temper.
It must be a new generation that stole your nags. We ain't responsible for them.
This is idle talk, Wilberger said. I happen to be responsible for 3,000 cattle and 11 men. If I could buy 40 horses, good horses, I'd feel happier. Can you oblige me?
We expect to have 100 head available at sunup tomorrow, Call said.
Gus's talkativeness had one advantage. It often gained him a minute or two in which to formulate plans.
I had no intention of spending the night here, Wilberger said. Anyway, I don't need 100 head, or 50 either. How many could I get this afternoon?
Augustus dug out his old brass pocket watch and squinted at it.
Oh, we couldn't sell horses now, he said. We're closed for the day.
Wilberger abruptly dismounted and automatically loosened his horse's girth a notch or two to give him an easier breathe.
I never expected to hear talk like this, he said. I never heard of a livery stable closing in bright daylight.
Oh, the stable don't close, Augustus said. We can stable anything you want us to. It's just the horse trading part of the operation that's closed.
Wilberger walked up to the porch.
That jug's for rent, all rent a swig, he said. I guess that jug's about the only thing that's still open in this town.
It's open and it's free, Augustus said, handing it to him.
While Wilberger was drinking, Augustus looked at Call. The remark about the 100 horses had struck him as bold talk, even if they were planning a swing through Mexico. Their main object on recent swings had been cattle. Now and again, they ran into a few horses and threw them in with the cattle, but seldom more than 10 or 12 in one night. Where the other 90 were to come from, Augustus didn't know.
Ain't there a whore in this town? Chick asked.
He was still horseback. The remark took everybody by surprise. Wilberger seemed quite displeased with it.
Chick, I thought you had a few manners, he said. Talking that kind of talk down at the lots is one thing. Talking it up here when I'm trying to discuss business with these gentlemen is something else.
Well, them boys at the lots wouldn't tell me, Chick said,
with a touch of a whine.
That's because they are God-fearing boys, Augusta said. You wouldn't catch them boys with no Jezebel.
Is that her name? Chick asked. It ain't the name I heard.
He's never learned to curb his passions, Will Barger said. I hope you'll excuse him. A loose tongue is never welcome, Augusta said mildly. Horses, Will Barger said, returning to the more important subject. This business about being closed is an irritation. I'd hope to be back at my herd by sunup. It's held in a bad place. The mosquitoes will eat most of my crew if I don't hurry. And if I could just get enough ponies to get me started, I might be able to pick up some extras as I go north. That's a risk, Call said. I know it's a risk. What ain't? Wilberger said. How many could you sell me this afternoon? Call was tired of beating around the bush. Three, he said. Three this afternoon and 100 tomorrow? Wilberger said. You must know a man with lots of horses to sell. I wish I knew him. But he mostly sells to us, Augusta said. We're lavish with money. Wilberger handed back the jug. You're lavish with time, too, he said. My time. We couldn't go to visit this man right now, could we? Call shook his head. Sun up, he said. Wilberger nodded, as if that was what he had expected. All right, he said. If you left me a choice, I don't notice it. He walked back to the black horse, tightened the girth, and pulled himself back into the saddle. You men won't disappoint me, will you? He asked. I'm mean as a tom turkey when I'm disappointed. We've always been taking it our word, Carl said. You can count on 40 horses at sunup. $35 a horse. We'll be here, Wilberger said. You won't have to hunt us up. Now wait a minute, Carl said. What's your horse brand, or do you have one? I have one. I brand Hick on the left hip. Are your horses shod, Carl asked. All shod, Wilberger said. Bring them if you see them. What's Hick stand for, Augustus asked. Well, it's Latin, Wilberger said. Easier than what you wrote on that sign. Oh, Augustus said. Where'd you study Latin? Yale College, Wilberger said. Then he and Chick trotted off. I'll figure he's a liar, Augustus said. Man like that went to Yale College wouldn't need to trail cattle for a living. How do you know, Carl said. Maybe the family went broke, or maybe he just wanted an outdoor life. Augustus looked skeptical. It was a shock to think that there was someone in town more educated than himself. Caught you off, didn't he, Carl said. You didn't even know what that short little word means. Why, it's short for hickoff, Augustus said blithely. It's a curious thing to brand on a horse, if you ask me.
You figure Jake's drunk, Carl asked.
Why, no, Augusta said. I figure he's happier than he was this morning, though. Why?
Because I want him sober tonight, Carl said. I want you both sober.
I could be as sober as the day I was born and not find no 100 horses, Augusta said. Those figures don't make sense. Wilberger needs 40, and we can't find that many anyway. What will we do with the other 60 if we was to find them?
We need a remuda ourselves if we go to Montana, Carl said. Augusta sat the jug down and sighed.
I could kick, Jake, he said.
Why?
For putting that idea in your head. Jake's an easy fella. Ideas like that float right through his head and out the other side. But no darn idea has ever made it through your head. Your brain would bog a mule. Here I've been living in a warm climate most of my life, and you want me to move to a cold climate?
Why not, if it's better country, Carl asked. Augustus was silent for a time.
I don't want to argue Montana right now, he said. I thought we were still arguing tonight. Where are we aiming to steal 100 horses?
Hacienda Flores, Carl said.
I knowed it, Augusta said. We ain't going on a cow hunt. We're launching an assault.
The Hacienda Flores was the largest ranch in Coahuila. It was there when the Rio Grande was just a river, not a boundary. The vaqueros would cross that river as casually as they crossed any stream. Millions of acres that had once been part of the hacienda were now part of Texas, but the vaqueros still crossed the river and brought back cattle and horses. They were, in their view, merely bringing back their own. The ranch headquarters was only 30 miles away, and it was there that they kept the main part of the horse herd, several hundred strong, with many of the horses wearing Texas brands.
"If I didn't know better, I'd say that you were trying to scare up a war," Augusta said. "Old Pedro Flores ain't going to make us a gift of 100 horses, even if he did steal all of them himself."
"Everything's got its risks," Carl said.
"Yeah, and you're as fond of risk as Jake is of women," Augusta said. "Suppose we get away with the horses, what then?"
"Sell Wilburger 40 and keep the rest," Carl said. "Pick up some cattle and head north."
"Head north? Who with?" Augustus asked. "We don't exactly add up to a cattle crew."
"We can hire cowboys," Carl said. "There's plenty of young cowhands around here." Augustus sighed again and stood up. It looked like the easy life was over for a while. Carl had idled too long, and now he was ready to make up for it by working 6 times as hard as any human should work. On the other hand, it would be satisfying to run off some of Pedro's horses. Pedro was an old rival, and rivalry still had its interest.
"Jake would have done better to let them hang him. You know how he suffers when he has to work."
"Now, where are you going?" Carl asked when Augusta started to walk off.
"Why, down to tell Jake the news. He might want to oil his gun."
"I guess we'll take the boy," Carl said. He had been thinking about it. If they were going to get 100 horses, they would need every hand.
"Why, good," Augustus said. "I'll tell Newt. He'll probably be so pleased he'll fall off the fence."
But Newt wasn't sitting on a fence when he heard the news. He was standing in the sandy bottom of Hat Creek listening to Dish Bogart vomit. Dish was upstream a little ways, acting very sick, and he had come walking up from the saloon with Jake Spoon and Mr. Gus, not walking too straight, but on his feet. Then he had stumbled over the edge of the creek and started vomiting. Now he was down on his hands and knees, still vomiting. The sounds coming out of him reminded Newt of the sucking sound a cow makes pulling her foot out of a muddy bog. Newt had been sick at his stomach a few times, but never that sick, and he was worried. Dish sounded like he was going to die. Newt would not have thought anybody could get so sick in such a short space of time. Mr. Jake and Mr. Gus didn't seem worried, though. They stood on the banks of the creek, chatting amiably, while Dish hung his head and made the sound like the bogged cow. With Dish in such trouble, Newt could hardly enjoy the good news Mr. Gus had told him, though it was news he had waited for years. Instead of floating with happiness, he was too worried about Dish to feel much of anything else. "You want me to get Bolivar?" he asked. Bolivar was the house doctor. Mr. Gus shook his head.
"Bolivar can't get a man over being drunk," he said. "Carl should have kept you boys working. If Dish had stayed down in that well, he never would have been tempted."
"A fish couldn't drink no faster than that boy drank," Jake said, "if fishes drink."
"They don't drink what he drunk," Augusta said.
He knew perfectly well that Dish had been love-smitten, and that that had been his undoing. "I hope the captain don't see him," Newt said. The captain was intolerant of drinking unless it was done at night and in moderation. No sooner had he said it than he saw the captain come out of the house and walk toward them. Dish was still on his hands and knees. About that time, Bolivar began to beat the dinner bell with a crowbar, though it was much earlier than their usual supper hour. He had evidently not cleared his action with the captain, who looked around in annoyance. The clanging of iron on iron didn't do much to improve Dish's condition. He began to make the boggy sound again. Jake looked at Augustus. "Carl's apt to fire him," he said. "Ain't there any excuses we can make for him?"
"Dish Bogart is a top hand," Augustus said. "He can make his own excuses."
Carl walked up and looked at the stricken cowboy, whose stomach was still heaving. "What happened to him?" he asked, frowning.
"I didn't see it," Augustus said. "I think he may have swallowed a hunk of barbed wire."
Dish, meanwhile, heard a new voice above him and turned his head enough to see that the captain had joined a group of spectators. It was an eventuality that he had been dreading, even in his sickness. He had no memory of what had happened in the dry bean, except that he had sung a lot of songs. But even in the depths of his drunkenness, he had realized that he would have to answer for it all to Captain